And with a special edition of Maine Calling, I'm Keith Shortall. If you have just heard from the president, and you have probably already heard, the U.S. Supreme Court on a 5-4 vote has upheld President Obama's signature legislative accomplishment, the Affordable Care Act. The ruling is being characterized as a political victory for the president. But what does it mean for the people of Maine and how they get their health care? We'll hear four perspectives on the ruling from our guests. Andrew Coburn is research professor and chair of health policy and management at USM's Muskie School. Dimitri Baum is an associate professor at the University of Maine Law School. Joe Dutre is founding executive director of Maine Consumers for Affordable Healthcare. And Joel Allenbaugh is director of the Center for Health Reform Initiatives at the Maine Heritage Policy Center. Welcome all. We'd like to hear from you as well. To join the conversation, call 1-800-399-3566. Let's go around the table with just initial reaction to today's ruling, starting with Joe Dutre. What does it mean for consumers in Maine?
Well, I think it's an important decision for consumers because we have 133,000 people in the state of Maine who have no health insurance, and we have other hundreds of thousands of them who find health insurance to be unaffordable. And so the importance of the Affordable Care Act is that for the vast majority of those people, they will now have a plan that makes healthcare more affordable by providing subsidies to those with incomes at or below 400% of the federal poverty level. And it will expand Medicaid coverage for people up to 133% of the federal poverty level. And it will provide tax credits to small businesses who are struggling with their healthcare costs. There are a host of other provisions that are very, very important to the people of the state of Maine, because and you know that because we've already adopted many of the provisions that are part of the Affordable Care Act, like the the pre-existing condition exclusions and coverage for kids. We did up to 25, and here they went up to 26, et cetera. So I think it's an important thing, but we still have more work to do. I mean, this was a decision on the law. Was the law constitutional? Now, I think we have to join together on both sides of the aisle and move forward to say now it's time to implement.
Joel Allenbaugh, what does it mean for Maine businesses?
I think it's a little disappointing because I think for many Maine businesses, it's going to mean higher insurance premiums. You know, this law is pretty expansive in a number of ways, and Mr. Dutre just characterized some of those, but there's very little in this law that actually address root underlying cost issues. And for many businesses, the decisions they make when they purchase health insurance and provide them to their employees are going to be taken out of their hands. And a lot of those decisions will be handed down to them. And for example, determining what type of policy to offer, what the deductible levels and things such as that. This law is going to direct them in many respects. And for many Maine businesses, it's going to mean turning in their current policies and replacing them with more expensive ones.
What does it mean specifically, do you think, for the insurance industry in Maine, the health insurance industry?
Well, the health insurance industry is, it's an interesting industry to say the least. But for the insurance industry, when you take premiums and you raise them, that obviously is a troubling dynamic for them. When you tell people that you have to buy the coverage and will subsidize for those that it's unaffordable, then, you know, I think the insurance company has an opportunity to win here. I hope that they take heed of this and make sure that they take a stance of responsibility to make sure that though these subsidies, I think in many cases, will divorce people from the real costs, that we still have and they have an important responsibility to make sure that they work to keep these premiums more affordable.
Andrew Coburn of the Muskie School, your thoughts?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is the ruling today really preserves many of the gains that have been made, number one, and I think those have already been mentioned by the president by Joe. But I think I would disagree with Mr. Allenbaugh to the extent that I don't think we really know how the law will be implemented with respect to its impact on individuals and small businesses who might purchase insurance through an exchange. I think that is going to depend a lot on how those exchanges are structured. And if Maine chooses to proceed in developing an exchange, I think there's an opportunity for Maine to change the insurance market in the state such that we might actually have more choices and that the choices will be better and not worse than what we have now.
Dimitri Baum, I have 100,000 questions for you as our constitutional law guest here, but let's get your general reaction first.
Well, I'm a little bit surprised, not at the outcome of the case, but at the way the case was decided. I think most of the focus in the lower courts, in the blogosphere, a lot of conferences were held around town, around the country, really focused on the Commerce Clause powers, whether Congress could require an individual to engage in commerce and whether that regulation is proper. The court ends up splitting 5-4, but finding the regulation proper under taxing power. And whether that is a relevant difference remains to be seen. But it's not a ruling that people were expecting, at least on the constitutional grounds.
This sort of nuanced distinction about upholding the law based on interpreting this as a tax, which was politically untenable. The Obama administration knew that a tax probably wouldn't
right.
be popular, but using the Commerce Clause might, and yet the court interpreted it as a tax anyway.
Well, and that's one of the reasons that I think the argument didn't gain traction. I think that the administration was trying to say, no, this is not a tax, and the Justice Department didn't press that argument as strongly as the Commerce Clause argument, as a Commerce Clause power argument. But I think once they saw the way that the lower courts were ruling, and there was sort of a fear that, hey, maybe the Commerce Clause argument is not a slam dunk, as some of the legal scholars were predicting, they started pressing that argument more strongly. And I think looking back on it, and there were some scholars who thought this is a tax.
One more law question.
Yeah.
Does this in any way expand the federal powers over states, or does it at least help sort of redefine the parameters or further define the parameters?
I think the general agreement right now is that it doesn't necessarily expand any of the powers. The Congress's taxing powers have always been, at least since the New Deal, have been seen as very broad. And there were a few limits in place, and none of those limits have been struck down in this case. I think the fear was that if the court had held that under the Commerce Clause powers, the court has the power to order an individual to engage in certain conduct, that might be a break from precedent or might increase congressional powers. There appears to be 5 votes to say that that's not the case, that Congress can't do this under Commerce Clause powers alone, that they have to use a taxing power.
Joel Allenbaugh, I know that constitutional law is not your area at the Heritage Policy Center, but do you see it, though, as an opinion that's of importance from the perspective of independent states' rights to run the things they want, the way they want?
Yeah, I do. And, it's interesting. There was a lot of argument around the Commerce Clause, and I think it's interesting that at the end they sort of shifted away from it. But I think changing the name of it doesn't change the spirit of it. And the reality is that people are being required to purchase a private insurance product.
Actually, I would just disagree.
Joe DeDray,
they're not being required. I mean, that's clearly what the decision says, that no individuals can be required to purchase insurance. Conversely, if they don't purchase the insurance, they can be penalized, and I think it's appropriate to call it a tax. The important thing that the court recognized and said was that in its decision was that the reason that they found this tax could survive under the taxing clause was that it was not so onerous as to force people to, in essence, end up buying health insurance. And I think that's a very important difference. And for what the president said at the end of his statement, basically it takes a, it, 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 this is a it, he didn't say this, so these are my words, but it's a free rider tax. What he said was people who don't buy health insurance and participate in the insurance risk pool are in essence passing their costs because they can't afford them. And many of them want to buy insurance, but they can't afford it. But they're passing those costs when they do receive medical care onto everyone else. Those who take advantage of the coverage and get, either small businesses or individuals who get the subsidies and come into coverage will reduce that risk of passing those costs on to others.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. Tweet at Maine Calling or email talk@mpbn.net. You can also post a message to our Facebook page. Maine is one of the states that challenged the constitutionality of this law. Andrew Coburn in court. We heard today from Attorney General Bill Schneider, who basically explains the court the state's position in that. But now he's in a position, or the state is, to carry through on these. Does it matter that the state government isn't behind this, even though it's supposed to carry it out?
Well, I think it certainly does matter, because I think Maine does have important choices to be made with respect to how it proceeds, both with respect to the private insurance market and also with respect to Medicaid. So on the exchange side of things, Maine has not proceeded in development of a robust exchange or much of an exchange. There is a framework that the legislature put together, but that was put on hold. I think it's going to be very important for the state to decide if we're going to let the federal government just run our exchange, or whether we're going to actively decide how we want to structure the insurance market in Maine and what the parameters might be in terms of that market for small group insurance purchasing and for individuals who are looking for coverage. And on the Medicaid side, states are no longer going to be penalized in the way that the law originally said for not participating in the Medicaid expansion, but Maine has the opportunity to participate in this expansion with virtually no state funds being put in to the Medicaid expansion until 2019, which would expand coverage to about 43,000 to 65,000 Mainers, quite frankly.
Yeah, explain who are those people for whom Medicaid would be expanded, Joe Dutre?
They're primarily people who have lower incomes, and the important thing is, for example, so at 100% of federal poverty for a single person, it's about $11,000 a year. For someone at 133% of federal poverty, it's about $15,000 a year. At 133% for a family of three, it's about $25,000 a year. As you can see, those are very those household incomes are low. And so they can't afford the $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 out of pocket for a family premium. So having those folks covered by the Medicaid expansion, and we hope that the state will move forward with the Medicaid expansion and bring as many people into coverage as possible, because of what Andy just said, up until – so 100% of those costs of bringing all those new people in would be picked up by the federal government through 2016. After that, it drops to 95% of those costs, and then to 90%. Maine would never have to pay the lion's share of the cost of bringing thousands and tens of thousands of people into coverage, because the feds will provide that.
But the feds would pay for that through taxes from Maine taxpayers.
And yes, I mean, but the important thing to remember is that if we don't take advantage of that, we suffer two problems. One, those people who don't have coverage will now go to hospitals, and they will incur debts that they can't pay and either lose their homes or pass those costs on to others. And other states would take advantage of it. If Maine doesn't take advantage of those federal funds, then some other state. So we would in essence be subsidizing California or New York or other states with our dollars.
So if we chose not to expand that Medicaid coverage, those people that you just described would not have coverage and would not be required to buy coverage. Aren't they essentially in the same place they are right now?
Not all of them would not have coverage, because we would just choose – I mean, the state may choose not to do the expansion portion of it. For those already covered under the Medicaid program, they would retain that coverage.
Andrew Cooper?
This is one of the questions we don't know yet have the answer to, but it's not clear what would happen to those individuals vis-a-vis the exchanges that would be set up. So it's possible that those people could go into the exchange and obtain subsidies in lieu of the Medicaid coverage. So that's all yet to be thought through.
Those are only the people who are above 100% of poverty. So in other words, between 100 and 133 would be the people who would.
And can you just translate that
into
dollars? Annual income?
Yeah. So 100% of federal poverty is where you can, at that household income, you can go into the federal exchange.
And 100% for a single person is about $11,000 a year. And for a family of three, it's about $15,000 a year. So that's the point in which you could get into the exchange.
Joel Allenbaum?
There's another important layer to this conversation I think we need to discuss. And when you talk about, you know, the states having only a certain portion of this cost, there's another cost component that we aren't talking about. There is a difference between someone going into a hospital, emergency room, or whatever medical provider with a Medicaid card versus a private insurance card. And the way in which Medicaid, for example, controls their costs is they underpay the providers. So if I go into a hospital as a Medicaid recipient, on average, that hospital is going to get about 70 cents on the dollar for what it costs them to deliver the care. So there's a cost shift that happens. And when you look at the dynamics of the market as a whole, the larger the group that is on the Medicaid, Medicare systems versus the private insurance systems exacerbates the rate impact on the private side. Private insurance companies reimburse at higher rates for the providers. So there is another cost component that we're not talking about that's a little more difficult to quantify, but it's a real cost when we expand Medicaid.
So is there room for the government to then say or the states to say, look, we recognize that and we'll pay more for screenings or we'll pay more for certain procedures? Could that rate card be changed in anticipation of that very issue?
Yes, absolutely. States can choose to pay their providers in a whole variety of manners. And in fact, there's a lot of effort to increase physician fees in most states to, you know, come up closer to market, either Medicare or private market, mostly Medicare.
Dimitri Baum, is it possible that in future some of the specifics of this bill that was upheld in general today could be challenged again for their constitutionality depending upon how they're implemented?
Certainly, you can always challenge a different provision of the law that has not been decided upon. But like the other commenters have said, it's hard to predict how the law is going to play out in the future. So I think it remains to be seen. I think one of the advantages of having a case decided is that now the states can move forward, can try to figure out ways to implement it without the sort of uncertainty hanging in the background. You know, who knows how it'll actually play out in practice and what will happen in the future. But at least now that we know that this piece is constitutional, the court has decided on it, sort of see what happens.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
More than 2 years after President Obama signed his health care law, the Supreme Court weighs in with a ruling that could reshape the healthcare industry, change the way you get and pay for medical care, and shake up the presidential campaign. I'm Neil Conan. The final ruling on the healthcare law and what it means for you. Join us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And you can join us for this special broadcast of Talk of the Nation this afternoon at 2 o'clock.
Tonight on Maine Watch, a special live program analyzing what today's Supreme Court decision on the Affordable Care Act means for Maine. Our guests, Maine Attorney General Bill Schneider and Elizabeth Mitchell, CEO of the Maine Health Management Coalition. We'll also hear reaction from a diverse group of Maine people and organizations. We hope you'll join us for a special Maine Watch tonight.
And you can join us for this special live Maine Watch tonight at 8 o'clock on MPBN Television and MPBN Radio. Or you can tune in for a rebroadcast tomorrow night at 9 on MPBN Television, tomorrow afternoon at 12:30 here on MPBN Radio.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we're talking about today's Supreme Court decision on the Affordable Care Act. With me in the studio, Dimitri Baum, associate professor at the University of Maine Law School, Joe Dutre, founding executive director of Maine Consumers for Affordable Healthcare, Joel Allenbaugh, the director of the Center for Health Reform Initiatives at the Maine Heritage Policy Center, and Andrew Coburn, research professor and chair of the Health Policy and Management at the Population Health and Health Policy at the Muskie School at the University of Southern Maine. That's probably more words than there are really in there. But welcome back. And we'd like to hear from you as well. Join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. 3566, email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. What's next for the sort of the average, Maine business? Let's start with Joel Allenbaugh here. Does it not at least give a sense of certainty as to what's happening, or are there still a lot of uncertainties that are making businesses unsure about how to proceed with benefit packages, for example?
Well, there's still a lot of things yet to be defined, so there's still a fair amount of uncertainty. But I think what I've been dealing with, I'm an insurance broker by trade, and what I deal with clients is sort of looking ahead to 2014 and trying to anticipate what decisions do they need to make and what do they need to be thinking about now. So I think in one respect, it will be helpful to at least understand that, yes, this is the universe they're going to live in. But again, for these businesses, they make a lot of decisions when they put their insurance plans in place, and they're going to have to really go back to the drawing board. It's going to be a challenging couple of years for them to make sure that their insurance plans fit the parameters that are required under the ACA. When the president was talking, he said that if you have your current insurance plan, you like it, you'll be able to keep it. I would challenge that. I could probably count on one hand the number of clients that actually have what we call a grandfathered plan. In most cases, they had zero option to have a grandfathered plan. It either was not offered from the insurance company or cost simply didn't enable them to maintain a grandfathered plan. What that means is that their current coverage needs to conform. And in doing that, we don't have complete clarity on what that is going to look like, but we do have a lot of expectation that it's going to be adding coverage, not taking it away, which is why I say we can expect to see costs increase for many Maine businesses.
In terms of choice, we've also heard critics, including candidate Romney, say that promises that people would be able to keep their current insurance and keep their current doctor are not true, that they could actually lose their insurance as they have it and their doctor. How do you see it?
I think that's absolutely right. I think most of these employers have already moved out of grandfathered plans, so in a sense they already have lost that flexibility. And we've also heard a number of physicians that may not stay in practice. So when you take a lot of the market and you put it into the government's hands and you control cost essentially by determining what you're going to pay physicians, we don't know what that will translate to. Will my doctor remain in practice in 2014 and beyond in this new environment? That's impossible for us to say.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I look at the situation as being somewhat unclear because we really don't have a lot of the information that will determine what the outcomes will be vis-a-vis the kinds of issues that Joel is raising. I do think that the essential benefits that, I mean, the federal government has provided states substantial flexibility in defining what essential benefits are. I think there is a framework that this law provides that is a general framework within which Maine will have to operate. That is certainly true, and there will be some conforming that will have to be done between what a plan a small business might have now versus what it might need to have under an exchange. But let me just say that we've been working in Maine since really for 25 years to try to expand health insurance coverage in the small group and individual market, and we have failed in any number of ways. We've been successful to some degree, but we've not been able to solve this problem. And that's because we don't have the resources to be able to provide the kinds of subsidies from the resources available within this state. And we need federal help to enable individuals and small businesses to be able to purchase insurance. And there are many small businesses who are uninsured who would like to purchase insurance but can't afford it. Whether these subsidies are going to be enough to get them into the market remains to be seen. But I think this is a framework that at least attempts to do that, and I don't see a lot of other alternatives on the horizon that would compete with at least this strategy.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. Let's go to Monroe and Nick. Hi, Nick. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Go ahead, please.
So the first thing I just wanted to say was, I feel really, really proud to have helped elect a president who finally made health care more affordable and accessible to hardworking Americans. It's a huge accomplishment. And secondly, I have a question. for someone making less than about, you know, $30,000 a year, what kind of options do I have as far as having access to health insurance or health care?
Joe Detroit?
Well, two things, and thank you for your call. Under the federal exchange, state, and as Andy pointed out, the state or the feds will run an exchange in the state now that the law has been upheld. We'll do a couple things. One, it will provide you with an apples-to-apples comparison of your health insurance options. And this is a very important thing that when the Massachusetts Connector Law, which is the first in the United States, it was Chapter 58 in 2006, was enacted. Massachusetts saw more small group insurers come into that market to offer more products and choices. And for the first time, both individuals and small businesses were able to, on an apples-to-apples basis, compare cost and the benefits. For someone with your income, you would be able to see what subsidy you would get and what your options are depending on whether you chose one of the four plans that are offered. And so it's a very, very important aspect because so many, and here in the state of Maine, of the 133,000 people that have no health insurance that I mentioned earlier, the vast majority, 95% or more of them, have incomes below 300% of the poverty level. So for a single person, that would be about $33,000 a year.
So how are we going to know, for example, about Nick's particular situation? Is this based on – does he apply? Is this based on his tax returns? How does this work?
To get more information, more of the specifics about at that level, how much of a subsidy would because this is all spelled out in regulation, how much of a subsidy would he get? He could always call our organization, Google us, Consumers for Affordable Healthcare, and we have all that information up on our website, but also we have a toll-free helpline where people would answer that question.
Yeah, it suggests if there are that many people – we're going to suddenly have to start doing a lot of paperwork to determine who's there and what they're eligible for. And I assume there will be disputes, and those will have to be
– Well, but take the example of Medicare Part D, which was the most complicated – by the way, enacted in a Republican administration and carried out with a Republican administration in a really incredible way. Very complicated set of benefits with different, you know, drug lists and so forth. It didn't involve paperwork so much as it involved people becoming informed and making choices. And the exchange list can be designed in a similar fashion to make this less complicated because insurance by nature is complicated. But it is possible, it seems to me, to create an exchange in which this can be simplified to a greater extent than it appears on paper at the moment.
Yeah, Joel.
Well, perhaps I'm a skeptic in the government's ability to do this, but I want to just point something out that I think is important. One of the things that the Affordable Care Act did, I think this illustrates what I'm feeling as I'm sitting here and hearing this, because I'm an insurance broker. So I spend my career trying to translate insurance to consumers. One of the provisions in the law says that insurance companies have to provide a standardized 4-page benefit summary. And the intent is just what Joe described, and it's an important attempt and a valid one, which is this is confusing stuff. We need to make it more understandable for people. However, the regulations that were released to give guidance to an insurance company on how to establish this 4-page benefit summary, which, by the way, can be no greater than 4 pages and I believe no smaller than 12-point font, if I'm remembering correctly, involved over 150 pages of regulations. It's easier said than done. You can intersect with the healthcare system in a countless number of ways. And it's never going to be simple simply because someone sitting in a chair says, you will make it simple. There is a level of complexity that flat out exists in managing your healthcare costs by transferring the risk to an insurance company. And there is going to be some level of complexity that remains in this system regardless. I think from my perspective, as I work with clients, what I see for regulations to be followed, we're talking about more paperwork, more compliance issues, more wading through the maze than we have today.
Well, I think any time that you see a complex piece of federal legislation, whether it's Fair Housing or Voting Rights Act or Title VII, Title IX, there's added burdens to some employers to states, and generally, I think states over time and employers over time are able to adjust to it and adjust to the load, sort of figure out ways to make the complicated regulations, how to implement them effectively without it sort of driving anybody out of business or at least not imposing too much of a burden as it might have seemed at first.
And just think about today. I mean, without the summary plan document that Joel was just mentioning, people would have to find a broker to call, and many individuals don't have brokers. Many small businesses don't have brokers to have someone explain over the phone, whereas you can see it right on your computer screen, apples to apples, what the benefits are and what the costs are.
Did Massachusetts already help us do this to some extent? Or?
Yeah, if you any of your listeners could go to just Google Massachusetts Connector and go on the website and look at a real live version of what will happen in 2014.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. Let's go to Lewiston and John. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Hey, I have a question because I keep hearing them say that this is a tax, and I know that the IRS has a lot of power when it comes to taxes. They come in to lean on your house, start taking everything you own. They can just go all out when it comes to this tax thing. Is this particular what they're calling a tax? Do they have the same kind of authority to implement that on a person as they do like a normal tax when you went out and made $30,000 and say now you owe the IRS this much money because you made that much money? Do they have that kind of authority with this just like a normal tax where they can put a lien on your home and the whole nine yards?
What authority do they have? What do you face as a penalty if you don't take part in the system?
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is that the penalty is calculated the same way as a percentage of your income, and it's collected the same way as any other tax as part of your 1040. So you do have a choice here, not to sign up for the individual mandate, not sign up for the insurance, but then you do have to pay this penalty, what the court calls a tax on your 1040. And I think that they also have the same powers as would collect any of other taxes.
So if you decide not to to pay the tax or whatever, what is the penalty amount?
I don't have the exact numbers. I think it's calculated based on your income. I think it starts at 1% of your income, but not to exceed a certain amount. So there's going to be a floor at a certain amount. It'll rise a little bit over the years. There's going to be a cap at a certain amount, and that'll rise over the years. But it's somewhere between 1 and 2.5% of your income. And there's going to be a lot of people who are not going to face a tax if their income is too low or meet certain conditions in the tax code.
This would come out of your tax return. If you were getting money back, you would not see that anymore.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
But if you didn't have any money coming back, then they would go ahead and put a lien on, say, your home and all that other stuff to collect what they say that you owe them for not having medical insurance. They would go at you just like you owed them money.
I think that's right. I think if you qualify, if you're required to pay this penalty under the law, and that the law applied to you, you would be required to pay it as you would any other of your taxes.
Does anyone know if this has played out in Massachusetts? Whether there are any examples of? Yeah, good question, John. Let's go now to Portland and Mike. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the program. Mike.
Yes.
Yes. Go ahead,
Hello.
Please. Yes. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had kind of more of a comment than a question. I guess on some levels I feel like, what President Obama has proposed and pushed through, to me seems like it's not quite enough. It's sort of, I feel like, there's so many costs in healthcare, and, I always end up questioning the amount of administrative costs, the amount of costs for, insurance companies and, I don't know enough to really go through it all, but, I feel like there's got to be a way to make the whole situation a little more direct. And, I personally lean more towards the, feeling of actually socializing the healthcare system to the point where, we all pay in, but we all receive the service. And actually, taking out a lot of these, costs that are associated with the buying and selling of insurance policies, and really looking at, like, should the medical industry be a for-profit industry? I think that healthcare should be a basic right that we all have as human beings, and it shouldn't be something that there's people making tons of money on, and, you know, really trying to come up with a plan that actually makes it so everyone can have health care and the actual cost could truly come down.
Well, we've heard, Mike, you know, critics of this plan have used the word socialism as a pejorative, because the assumption is, I think most people don't support socialism in this country. Politically, it's not workable. How socialist is this, Andrew Goldberg?
So I think this is a pretty far cry from what most other countries that are thought of as having socialized medicine systems, which are essentially national healthcare systems, for example, Britain,
Scandinavia,
or Canada, which has a national health insurance framework that is what we call single payer. So this law is built around our existing healthcare system to try to strengthen and identify and address gaps in the system in terms of coverage and financing. And that's probably a good thing from a political standpoint, because it's the way in which the plan got passed and was acceptable. The downside of it is that it has the same problems that our healthcare system does have. And Joel is absolutely right. I think the law lacks enough cost control on the healthcare system. I think that is the big, huge problem in our healthcare system that is not being addressed to the extent that we'd all like it to be, because most other socialized countries have budgets for their healthcare system, and that's the way in which they control the spending and costs of their system. We don't have a budget system. We have a system that relies on some combination of market forces and the government in terms of how they price services. And I think it's, you know, there's a lot going on in the private sector that is very promising, and there's a lot in this bill that is now moving forward already and on the ground that is promising. But it remains to be seen whether or not we can really change the cost problem that we have in the system.
Joel?
Yeah, and I think you have to step back and look at what are the problems that have led us to where we are today. And from my perspective, a lot of the issue is the fact that we don't have enough market forces. You know, we don't have a connection to the cost of our care when we go in and receive it most often. So there's a, you know, for example, the insurance company in many cases negotiates with the doctor. They come up with the fees for services. The employee lives their life the way they choose. That may involve, you know, drinking, smoking, and not exercising. When they get sick and need care, they go in, expect world-class care, and oftentimes get it. And then in most cases, we turn around and send the bill to the employer. And there's this immense disconnect. And in my work, we've seen better cost control within insurance plans by aligning incentives and making sure that we're connecting people to the behaviors, the personal decisions that they make, and ultimately the cost of the care they receive as a result. When you take this program and you further disassociate people from the choices that they make to the ultimate cost that we all pay, and shroud it, if you will, in subsidies. I mean, Medicare alone, how far off was the government on this? I think 50 times. You know, we're talking about a couple $1 trillion here hitting the deficit. I think that's a fraction of what this will be in the long run. And I am very concerned about that further disassociation from people, patients, our behaviors, and what that ultimately is going to translate to when we intersect with the healthcare system down the road.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll hear more from our guests, and we'll talk to Barry in Portland and Dick in Old Town and Alice in Richmond. We'll be right back.
Tonight on Main Watch, a special live program analyzing what today's Supreme Court decision on the Affordable Care Act means for Maine. Our guests, Maine Attorney General Bill Schneider and Elizabeth Mitchell, CEO of the Maine Health Management Coalition. We'll also hear reaction from a diverse group of Maine people and organizations. We hope you'll join us for a special Maine Watch tonight.
And join us for Maine Watch live this evening at 8 p.m. on MPBN Television and MPBN Radio. Or if you miss that, join us tomorrow at 9 on MPBN Television or tomorrow at 12:30 on MPBN Radio.
Tonight, it's an NPR News special. The U.S. Supreme Court rules on the Affordable Care Act, President Obama's signature achievement. The health care case is one of the most important in a generation. I'm Jennifer Ludden. Join me for a one-hour special on today's decision and its implications. It's an NPR News special. The Supreme Court rules on the health care law.
And you can tune in for that NPR special this evening at 7 o'clock. This is listener-supported MPBN Radio, the Maine Public Broadcasting Network. WMED Calais 89.7, WMEF Fort Kent 106.5, WMEA Portland 90.1, WMEP Camden 90.5, WMEM Presque Isle 106.1, WMEH Bangor 90.9, WMEW Waterville 91.3, and also on the web at mpbn.net. A programming note, the previously scheduled 1 p.m. program, a city arts and lectures program, with economist, author, and former Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration, Robert Reich, will not be heard today due to the recent decisions from the Supreme Court. We will reschedule that program. Please listen for updates on when that program shall be.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to an extended version of Maine Calling. Today on the program, what the Supreme Court's ruling on the Affordable Care Act means for people in the state of Maine. With me in the studio, Dimitri Baum is associate professor at the University of Maine Law School, Joe Dutre, founding executive director of Maine Consumers for Affordable Healthcare, Joel Allenbaugh, director of the Center for Health Reform Initiatives at the Maine Heritage Policy Center, and Andrew Coburn, research professor and chair of health policy and management at USM's Muskie School. And we're hearing from you as well. Let's go to Old Town and Dick. Hi, Dick. Welcome to the program. Dick? Dick, are you there? I do not hear you. Let's try Alice in Richmond. Hi, Alice.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead, please.
You hear me?
Yes, yep, you're on.
Well, my comment has to do with my continuing aggravation about the Affordable Care Act, proponents' failure to really address those of us who are above the 400% cutoff for a subsidy. There's very little attention paid to us, and, you know, right now, 400% of federal poverty for a single person. I have a solo business. I have a solo law practice. I'm paying close to $7,000 a year to have a $3,000 deductible with another couple thousand in out-of-pocket exposure for coinsurance, and I don't get a subsidy. The cap at 400% of federal poverty, right now it's about $43,400, which I keep saying is about what the average teacher earns in this state, and try telling the average teacher that you can afford to pay for coverage, and if you're 52 years old and you live in Saginaw County, it's going to run you $7,000 a year to have a $5,000 out-of-pocket annual exposure. They'd go bonkers. The Kaiser folks have a website that has a subsidy calculator, and they point out that, you know, they run the numbers. They project 400% of federal poverty for a single person to be $46,000 in 2014. If you earn $115 more than that, and you're at 400%, 401% of federal poverty, you get no subsidy. And the projected cost of the Silver Plan, which is the plan that you have to get in order to get a subsidy, still leaves you with $6,000 in annual out-of-pocket exposure, still has a high deductible, but that plan at 401% of federal poverty will represent 19.5% of that person's gross income. So, you know, the president said that, you know, for those who can't afford coverage, we'll give you a subsidy, and that's simply not true.
Well, let's let our panel respond here. I think we get the gist of your case there. Are these numbers, Joe Dutre, that can be tweaked in these cases where people are, like, falling into unfair gaps?
I think that Alice raises a good point, and this is when you're trying to move forward with legislating and creating a new system, in essence, one that rectifies the problems in our current system. That you basically create cliffs, and that the good news is that moving forward, that now that the act has been declared constitutional, that those changes can be made. In other words, if we didn't have this in place, then the problems would persist. I mean, it would in fact be exacerbated without, for example, bringing more people into coverage through subsidies would actually result in higher premiums because you have fewer people in the insurance pool, more people going to get free care at hospitals, which I should point out for every one of your listeners, does not cover lots and lots of services. It's a limited set of services. But then again, leaving bills at the hospital that get passed on to people like Alice. So the important point is now that this law is here, now is the hard work of addressing the concerns of people like Alice and who need more help.
Let's try Dick again in Old Town. Dick, are you there?
Yes.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Thank you very much. The technology of healthcare is getting so good, particularly in the domain of the aged and the dying, that no matter what hocus pocus or legerdemain you put in place of subsidies and insurance, the fraction of the gross domestic product that's going to be allocated to healthcare is going to rise and rise and rise. And there's going to have to be put in place some form of rationing of health care. And I'd like to hear your experts discuss the ultimate use of rationing in the distribution of health care. Thank you.
So I'll jump in on that one. Probably shouldn't, but I will.
Andrew Coburn of the Muskie School.
So I think you raise a really important point because, you know, Joel mentions the importance of financial incentives to changing behavior that we all engage in with respect to how we consume healthcare services. But the other side of it is also that we have to understand better the choices we have to make medically and what the implications of those are, not just financially, but with respect to quality of life and everything else. One of the very important provisions in this particular piece of legislation is that there will be a much greater emphasis on what we call in healthcare the development of shared decision-making capacity. This is something that is already going on whereby physicians and patients can really understand better the choices that a patient faces with regard to either end-of-life care or even whether to do surgery, whether not to do surgery. And the bill actually places a pretty heavy emphasis on the development of better methods for enabling patients to be more engaged in making the choices that make sense for them.
Joel Ellenbaugh?
Yeah, I think, you know, and I want to jump back to Alice as well, and because I think she's exactly right. Subsidies cost money, and somebody pays them. And so if you can talk about however many of us fall under the 400%, there's a whole bunch that don't, that are going to be paying for this. And making it more expensive, making it less expensive for somebody without changing the underlying cost structure is making it more expensive for somebody else. And oftentimes it's more expensive for those who are your business folks, who are hiring, making decisions about whether they're going to expand, whether they're going to offer jobs, and so on and so forth. So I just want to mention that because I think it's an important point. And, you know, is there some level of rationing? To some extent, there probably always will be in healthcare, whether it's personal rationing, we're making our own decisions, whether we want to seek care based on cost. But I want to point something out that I think is also important because Dick mentioned technology. Generally speaking, in the economy, we see enhances in technology over time often result in increased efficiencies at lower costs. You know, I have this little unit on my hip here that I can now not only, you know, talk to somebody, but I can look at my emails, I can jump on the internet, and so on and so forth, and it's about a fraction the size of it was when I first had a device, and it's less expensive than some of those early devices. Market forces are important, and when you look at aspects of the healthcare system that fall out of this sort of dysfunctional third-party payer system, you see, for example, LASIK eye surgery, which my wife has been looking at for a number of years and trying to make a decision, do I want to go down that road? Well, we've watched the technology get better, we've watched the outcomes get better, and we've watched the cost decrease. But that's something that generally falls outside of our insurance plans. So again, as we sort of disassociate ourselves as consumers from the cost, I think we have a real problem with those costs. I think rationing would be a lot less of an issue if we could get market forces to work to bring the cost down to begin with.
Are you also saying that developments in medicine would be less driven because of when the free market aspect is excised? from it? In other words, that drives innovation in medicine?
Absolutely. It drives innovation in any sector of the economy where market forces are allowed to do their work.
Joe Dutre?
I've got to disagree with Joel here. When some folks talk about driving market forces, what they're actually referring to is to shift more of those costs onto the consumer. And we see in Maine, with many of the health plans in the individual market and now growing in the small group market, where you have $5, $10, and $15,000 deductibles before one penny is paid after you've paid tens of thousands of dollars of premium. And so that doesn't – that's what the market is moving toward. And under this law, it would limit that ability to move in that direction. The where I agree with Joel is that looking at underlying health care costs, and one of the callers mentioned administrative costs. We know that because we have a fragmented system with so many different plans that those costs are high. But also we know that one-third of the of what we are spending today, one-third, is for unnecessary care or for ineffective care. And so where we could all agree is let's look at that. You know, looking at the administrative mechanism of how the costs get paid for is really is a distraction. And where we really need to be focused is not who pays but how much they pay. And that's where the hard work is because you find it is so politically difficult to get large medical institutions, pharmaceutical providers, many others who have to be part of this discussion to negotiate. And that hasn't happened to date.
1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Yarmouth and Laura. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I've been listening to your conversation and enjoying all the different viewpoints. And I just had a question, comment, response to one of the previous callers who called about the question of taxing, and if it's considered a tax. And I wonder if you all could look into that because my understanding is different from the response, the answer from the insurance broker. My understanding is that there's a waiver of penalty, meaning that there is actually no enforcement. That the IRS would not be garnishing wages or withholding your tax return. I may be incorrect, but I think as a service to the listeners, if somebody could check the facts, that would be appreciated.
Sure. Anybody? Anybody? I'm seeing a bunch of shaking heads, Laura. If anyone knows, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Good question. Let's go to Jessica in Acton. Hi, Jessica.
Hi. I just have one. Thank you for having me on. I just have one quick question. I want to know what's going to become of Derigo, because I know under the new Maine law, Derigo is supposed to disappear in 2014, and yet over the years, people have talked about it as being a model for a potential model for an exchange system.
For those just visiting the state, Derigo was Maine's subsidized health care program. Joe Dutre?
Yeah, it's a very good question because it really points that the direction that this new law and framework that it provides was previewed here in the state in a small, very, very small way by Derigo, in that Derigo offered subsidies to people with incomes, both employees and businesses as well as individuals with incomes under 300% of the federal poverty level, and provided coverage that was fairly comprehensive. It didn't have the exchange where you could look at all the options, et cetera, et cetera.
And it ran into trouble, on the funding side, and the membership was frozen. And
yeah, after years of litigation by opponents to expanding this type of coverage, and again, this was a voluntary program in the introduced into the private market to offer private another option on a subsidized basis. After the years of litigation, that had an effect, and so as you can see, with the new majority in the Maine legislature, they decided that they were going to basically end the coverage. And I should point out for any of your listeners that coverage is still available. Subsidized coverage is still available. available in the DIRIGO program. But as of December 31st of 2013, that coverage will end. Thankfully, now with the exchanges coming online under the Affordable Care Act, there will be a connection.
All right, we're going to take another short break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions, and we'll talk to June in Penobscot. We'll be right back.
More than 2 years after President Obama signed his health care law, the Supreme Court weighs in with a ruling that could reshape the health care industry, change the way you get and pay for medical care, and shake up the presidential campaign. I'm Neil Conan. The final ruling on the health care law and what it means for you. Join us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation gets underway this afternoon at 2 o'clock.
Tonight on Main Watch, a special live program analyzing what today's Supreme Court decision on the Affordable Care Act means for Maine. Our guests, Maine Attorney General Bill Schneider and Elizabeth Mitchell, CEO of the Maine Health Management Coalition. We'll also hear reaction from a diverse group of Maine people and organizations. We hope you'll join us for a special Maine Watch tonight.
Join us for that special live Maine Watch tonight at 8 on MPBN television and radio, or tomorrow night at 9 on MPBN television, tomorrow afternoon at 12:30 here on MPBN radio. Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listener contributions and by the University of Southern Maine, the convenience of online programs, the quality of USM faculty, usm.maine.edu/finishyourdegree.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, what the Supreme Court's ruling on the Affordable Care Act means for the people of Maine. With me in the studio, Dimitri Baum, Associate Professor at the University of Maine Law School, Joe Dutre, Founding Executive Director of Maine Consumers for Affordable Health Care, and Joel Allenbaugh, Director of the Center for Health Reform Initiatives at the Maine Heritage Policy Center, Andrew Coburn, Research Professor and Chair of Health Policy and Management at USM's Muskie School. The number to call to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Email talk at mpbn.net, post to our Facebook page, or tweet at Maine Calling. And as promised, let's go to Penobscot and June. Hi, June. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, fellows. I will try to be succinct.
Thank you.
I'm 60 years old. I was brought up in Washington County. I had no health care whatsoever. I continued on in life without health care, and then in January 2006, I found myself suffering all of the very bad consequences of untreated diabetes. I was forced to go into the system and get Maine care, which was a great deal of shame to me because I've always paid my way, but I had nothing, and I am grateful that it was there. But in going into the allopathic system, I see a number of problems. But first and foremost, I'd like to point this out. We are citizens. We are not consumers. We are citizens first. Every time a politician or others refer to us, we are always referred to as consumers. That is not the idea of what a democracy is, regardless of what we consider to be the flotsam and the jetsam that we all carry for each other. Now, the alternative health system, which offers much education in preventative medicine as well as alternative therapies, needs to be incorporated into the what is called medical industrial complex.
June, let me ask you, what sorts of treatments are you talking about?
For me, I avoided a lot of, that they really were very kind to me and gave me options, but they know that I'm very intelligent and that I would take responsibility for my own health. So I ended up on insulin, and I ended up, first I started on metformin. I didn't work well with that, and I shifted my diet. But diabetes is not just a situation where we have diminished our nutrition and our consumer choices for food. It is a disease of fear, trauma, and starvation that all peoples around the world have gone through and are under right now. The stress.
So, is your question
of our culture is right. Difficult?
Is your question about alternative medicine? I'm still trying to get at what you said. You'd be succinct, but I'm not sure what the question is.
Well, I just want to point out we are citizens. We're not consumers. There are a few points I'd like to make to offer solutions. One of the things
June, sorry, we don't really have a lot of time. If you have a question or comment, real quickly,
we'll. For the woman client who wants to have any kind of health care concerning birth control. And quickly, if they want to have the commodity, if they want to have this be a free enterprise system, a free market system of goods, and as Mitchell O'Connell said last week, of ideas, why don't they tax the billions of dollars in campaign money that's being spent to elect, to buy a presidency? We need to have democracy rule. It's not socialism for us to be each other's keepers and to find new ways to cut costs.
Okay. Thanks, June. Any comments on June's? Yes, Joel.
I think part of, I know there wasn't really a question there, but I think part of what she's talking about is having choices. And you asked about alternative medicine. And just to loop back to what I mean by market forces, and I don't mean shifting more costs to consumers. Let's talk about things like health savings accounts, where in many cases those programs start with higher deductible policies, but the savings are reinvested into these accounts that employees and individuals can use to cover for their health care, to pay for their health care. And what we find statistically is that people spend their own dollars differently when they direct them themselves versus when an insurance company tells them how to spend them. When we talk about markets, we're talking about allowing people the opportunity to take those dollars, not force them into a system, but let them remain some have some control over those and make value decisions. For example, using alternative care, acupuncture if I want to. And I would point out that information is critical, and it's something that we don't have at the patient level. For example, knowing that the MRI is going to cost $2,000 if I go get it in the morning versus $700 in the afternoon, those are the types of things that happen in our current system because of that disconnect.
I think that avoids the point that June was mentioning, though, is that thankfully the safety net for her was the fact that she qualified for Medicaid and that her medical needs were met. And where a high deductible health savings account wouldn't have helped her is that, number one, she wouldn't have the money to buy one of those, nor would it help her to basically have that money, you know, the money set aside in the health savings account. She couldn't afford it. So, again, it's important that there be these types of supports, these types of safety nets available to people that the free market at this point has not provided.
Let's bring Jerry into the conversation. He joins us from Booth Bay. Hi, Jerry.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking the call. My point is that I don't believe the free market forces apply to health care. The patient or the consumer is not free to choose whether to enter the system or not. And when they're in the system, they are not usually sufficiently informed to make a choice, but they depend on the provider to effectively recommend what they need and what it's going to cost. Free market forces don't apply.
Is Jerry's point here really the core of this, the debate in terms of public policy?
Well, it's an important part of the debate, and I think everybody's right here in this conversation. On the one hand, market forces do make a difference in terms of the choices we make, in terms of the type of health plan that we buy, and particularly with discretionary services. Joel mentions the LASIK example, and that's a very competitive market. But the costs in healthcare are not in discretionary services. The costs in healthcare are with the third of us who have very serious illness, who have chronic disease. And that's when market forces really don't work particularly well, and where there's a real need to add to whatever market forces we have in the system other mechanisms whereby we can control the unnecessary and inefficient care that gets provided, not for the benefit of the patient or for the benefit of better outcomes, but simply because that's the way the healthcare system works, and it's not a very efficient or effective system at this point. And that's the difficult part of controlling costs.
But let's translate. If you have someone who's very ill, there are still huge discrepancies in quality of services from one place to the next. So market forces still do have a place. I may not be able to choose my illness or choose even my course of treatment, but I can certainly choose where I get it, what the efficiency of that is, and oftentimes differences in outcomes based on those choices if I have the information to make them.
See, I took the caller to be making a different point, which was for individuals and for small business, everything other than the very, very largest of businesses, we don't have a competitive market that brings down costs for us. We don't – even you look at your insurance company, they don't use their bargaining clout to bring down prices. They give the hospitals basically a discount off of charges, but that isn't bringing down prices and making healthcare more affordable for the vast majority of us.
Jerry, we'll give you the last word here.
I agree with most of what was said. I just don't believe that the market is going to work when it comes to healthcare. This cries to be a regulated utility. Thanks for the call. Taking the call.
All right. And we have about a minute left. I want to give each of you a chance to give me a quick summation of what's next. Joe Dutre?
Well, I think that and I hope that this is a great opportunity for the state of Maine to move forward together to implement this law to provide more people with subsidized coverage who can't afford it now and for small businesses to take advantage of those tax credits. It's very, very important to keep the market regulations in place so that people with pre-existing conditions who have been rated in the past on the basis of those conditions or their gender, that doesn't happen anymore. We still have a long way to go. I mean, the callers that pointed out the need for more cost containment, the need for people who are above the subsidy levels to for relief for them, that's all there, but we need to keep moving forward.
Joel Allenbaugh?
We need to keep focusing on the cost of care, and I think there's a lot of agreement around the table here. The underlying delivery costs, we can wrap subsidies and we can wrap insurance policies around a very inefficient, dysfunctional system, but the reality is until we get at the root of those costs and have a more affordable, more efficient delivery system, we're going to be struggling with cost into the future.
Dimitri Baum?
Well, I think I haven't met anybody who thinks that this is the perfect law or was their sort of first choice. So, you know, generally we think of the Supreme Court as the last stop, but it's a last stop only for the constitutionality of this law. There's a lot of work to be done to determine sort of what the best policy is going forward.
All right. Andrew Coburn, real quick.
Well, I just say that I hope that Maine citizens get engaged in the discussion going forward now that we've settled the constitutionality of this act. And I hope we don't get bogged down in the continuing ideological debate about the law and instead focus on the real issues that we face in healthcare.
All right. Thank you all. Andrew Coburn, research professor and chair of health policy and management at USM's Muskie School. Dimitri Baum, associate professor at the University of Maine Law School. Joe Dutre, founding executive director of Maine Consumers for Affordable Healthcare. And Joel Allenbaugh, director of the Center for Health Reform Initiatives at the Maine Heritage Policy Center. Today's program produced by Jonathan Smith. Our volunteer Scott McAuliffe answered your calls. John Keimel ran the board. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.